This episode of AVXL is recorded on May 10th, 2018. We're going to talk about the 2018 TV reviews that are rolling out, people. Kavo, which has taken home theater remotes to the next level. Chroma subsampling, a.k.a. 444 versus 420, and the dearth of subwoofer outputs on stereo amplifiers. All that and so much more coming up on AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home video and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
I am Robert Herron.
And I am putting down the lime and the orange I was holding to balance myself.
The bowl of fruit comes in handy.
On my 17 attempts to read the cold open for this show.
Or is citrus a fruit? I don't know.
Well, if it carries the seeds, it's a fruit, even if it's a vegetable. That was science. We'll talk about that later. Hey, man, we've been sciencing my oldest child recently.
I love the science, baby.
We'll talk about Kavo in a sec. Kavo's fascinating because the idea is that this is like using machine vision and intelligence and, you know, we're kind of edging towards that Arthur C. Clarke, any technology sufficiently advanced enough is indistinguishable from magic, because it's aware of your devices and your content up to a point. And you can talk to it if you're lonely.
I'm still recovering from Google's I.O. 2018. There was more than one thing that was just like, wow, that's pretty damn cool. In particular, their duplex demo. It is interesting the way they enabled...
Like, I need a haircut?
Yeah. You know what? It seems that if you can insert ums and ahs into synthetic speech, it's more convincing that it's a real person.
What a wonderful statement on speech in the 21st century.
So
feel free to
email.
So,
like, my ability to say so, if you're gonna synthesize me, you got to use so at the end of every sentence.
Well, it tells you a lot about what they've learned from a couple years of Google Home listening to requests from people.
They record everything.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you allow them to.
I mean, a large part of my ability to get the results I want out of Google search is I have some very strange natural language search skills where I can figure out the odd combinations of words that actually yield the results I want.
Right.
Comma, idiot savant, see me.
Okay, your ums, my sos, and there's another one I use all the time.
Like,
totally. I got to stick with delicious.
I'd like to apologize to everyone who's been listening to the podcast so far.
Delicious.
Let us move to the home theater and audio technology portion of the podcast. I know the AI demo is fascinating. It's
that was really
terrifying.
Cool. I even like the new Maps update. Can't wait to see that out in the wild as well. I use Maps a lot, be it Waze or Google. That has been a game changer for many, many years now. And remember the days when it used to be like you had a Garmin. You had this static device that's rarely updated. And now it goes to this full dynamic experience.
Well, I remember
experience
when that static device that was rarely updated was a miracle. You know.
GPS.
Because I also remember having a laptop on the passenger seat of my car with, like, I can't even remember the name of the cards you would insert. There was a card you would insert in the side of the
PCMCIA.
Laptop. Yeah, PCMCIA. With a cable to the antenna/GPS unit that went on your dashboard.
Oh, yeah. Microsoft used to sell a kit. I forget the name of the product now, but that just, I had a flashback for
that.
I
still have one of those GPS adapters because one of their last versions was this universal kind of functioning, slow for GPS these days, but it functions with weird versions of Linux and stuff.
What's built into your phone is pretty cool. And I can keep going off topic here, but there was a really cool...
You know, you can watch movies on your phone and listen to music.
Apparently. And I want to say it was Uber that posted a white paper recently about how to further improve the accuracy of the GPS in your phone. And it's, if you can Google that and take a look, and take a look at that article in terms of how they're determining, like, in congested environments or say in downtown street environments where you've got tall buildings all around you blocking GPS signals, how it can determine through machine learning and other techniques which side of the street you might be on when you have a general accuracy of GPS that might be, you know, 90 feet, and you'd really like to narrow that down to something like, say, 10 feet or better.
I just want Uber to figure out that they have issues with their mapping system with perfectly capable functional mapping data in areas where GPS signals aren't an issue. For example, deciding at the last minute to send the driver to the other side of the four lanes of the street in Oakland, but telling me to be on this side of the street in Oakland.
If you are a fan of Google Maps or Waze, and you come across an issue with the particular navigation that isn't
submit
right,
a fix.
Submit that fix. Please do. And that helps us all.
Yes.
The group
Give
think.
Back. Not even group think, just, or just know, a, group sourcing of
yeah.
information.
Okay, this is broken and we all use it, so fix this one turn or this one location does not require me to get back on the freeway. And then realize, no, I was never supposed to get on the freeway. I got to get back off now and go back to where I just was.
More inertial anyway. We need inertial navigation.
Heck
on submarines.
Yeah. The fusion stuff, it's just like, oh, anyway, I could go down this road. I love this kind of stuff.
That's anyway. It for this week in GPS. My name is Patrick Gorton. If you'd like us to start a GPS and
seriously
and,
general
and road
technology
trip podcast. Oh my goodness. Okay, well let's talk about we got a question from Nathan.
And, what's up, Nathan?
Nathan says, "Hi Nathan. With the new 6 series from TCL coming out, what are your thoughts on getting a larger LCD versus a smaller OLED for the average size living room?" And you've heard us say this before, probably 34 million times, err to the larger screen whenever possible. If you're going to buy a 55-inch screen, if you can swing it, get a 65-inch screen. You know, if you're thinking about a 75-inch screen, why not just get a 100-inch projector?
You get into 80-plus-inch LCDs, and that can either get expensive or you're not getting, like, optimal image quality
right.
for the money you might want to spend.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. OLED's going to give you some of the very best picture mm-hmm. quality in terms of it being able to produce the most contrasted picture of any of the display technologies out there today. It can make your standard dynamic range, your regular TV, your regular DVDs and Blu-rays look almost HDR or high dynamic range just by the nature of it being able to do such inky dark black.
Right. It turns the pixel off. The pixel turns black. It's black levels beyond even what everybody remembers the Kuro TVs being back in the day.
They were great and they still are, but this is infinite.
But not infinite like I am playing games with my measuring equipment to have lying specs, but it's literally black.
Yeah, and zero.
Stupid bright, which gives you a staggeringly awesome range of contrast or brightness. But if you have the money at this time, if image quality is your number one, biggest, hugest, most critical, everything is about having the best possible Blu-ray or UHD Blu-ray or Dolby Vision or HDR10. If you are all about the best possible image quality, you want no LED right now still.
I would thoroughly agree with that, especially also if you're dealing with wide viewing angles. There's very few displays that are going to look as good sitting off to the side as an OLED would. And that's something else to keep in mind, depending on what type of room you're dealing with or where generally people are going to be seated. I would always go back to, bigger is going to be better. A lot of people underestimate the size of the TV they need. If you have a larger room, a 65-inch TV can kind of be dwarfed within that environment, and you want to step it up. But when you start talking about, like, say, for OLED, your max screen size is going to be 77 inches for this year. Those start at $8,000. So on the budget side of things, suddenly that 6 series from TCL is looking a hell of a lot better in terms of how much it's going to cost you, considering the 65 inches retailing for under $1,000. And checking out the reviews for the 2018 TVs that are starting to roll out, Mr. David Katzmeyer over at CNET had his review of the TCL 6 series posted, and it follows up upon what we saw and what I checked out when I was in Las Vegas for CES earlier this year. Now, the 2018 6 series is the successor for the 2017 P series. Overall, the main improvements you're going to see if you put these two side by side will be picture uniformity and off-axis viewing. In addition to that, it remains one of the lowest lag LCDs you can currently get. So if you're a gamer, you're talking some of the very best performance, at least with 1080p input. I'd be curious to see how it changes with 4K input. In terms of absolute brightness, they are not going to beat the best Samsungs out there. Samsung has some crazy bright tech in some of their latest QLED TVs where it can hit over almost 4,000 nits for very short periods of time. But generally, it's around, say, 2,300 or so nits consistently on a 10% window. Whereas with the 2018 6 series from TCL, you're getting something that's still breaking 800 nits in HDR, about two or three times brighter than the old school LCDs that we've all come to adore. Now, in terms of color performance, the 6 series is also LED-based, And it's not quantum dot enhanced like the Samsung TVs generally are. So its absolute color performance won't be as saturated as the TVs that utilize quantum dot technology for improved color saturation. However, it's still very good. It's using wide color gamut LEDs. I just find that even the best LEDs out there today still don't seem to be hitting the same level that quantum dot enhanced TVs are. I'll be curious to see if further improvements in things like the LCD color filter and it being properly paired with that backlighting system can further improve the current state of LEDs, or if they simply come up with a way to produce even more saturated color with that. But still, if you're looking for the best color performance in an LCD panel today, it's going to be quantum dot based. Also, TCL TVs are powered by Roku, and it simply rocks. You end up with that snappy interface. It's frequently updated. It's simple to use and understand. And it has cool features, too, for a variety of situations. Not only just the streaming stuff, but if you're an over-the-air TV viewer, there's some great pause and DVR functions that are actually built right into the TV. It's a pretty fantastic deal. You also end up with Dolby Vision and HDR10 support built into a quote-unquote value TV. So if you're into the HDR streaming experience in 4K, these are going to look fantastic. And literally, if you want to beat one of these new TCL 6 series TVs, you're going to be spending two or three times more money to do it. And that's kind of really what it comes down to. You are limited in terms of sizes at 55 and 65 inch. There may be one other size I'm forgetting off the top of my head. Is there a 75 inch? No, I don't believe there is, but anyway, that was a terrific review, I want to say, out of the CNET crew and Mr. Katzmeyer. It just highlights what we thought was going to happen back in January at CES when we previewed the new 6 series. Freaking fantastic. And speaking of reviews, I have to give a shout out to the HDTV test folks who took a look at the new LG C8 OLED. Mr. Vincent Teo, man, he did a solid job taking a look at the latest iteration of LG's OLED panel technology. Not to give too many spoilers, but he found an issue with almost every new feature within this TV. However, no showstoppers, but let's go over some of those issues he encountered. One, the AutoCal feature, which has been touted in terms of utilizing what they call a 3D lookup table that can be programmed with appropriate software and meters to provide superb color accuracy. And that feature actually works just fine in terms of providing that color accuracy. Yet when completed, it seemed to introduce some banding into test patterns that wasn't there prior to using that feature. And by using the manual calibration controls built into the C8 OLED, that artifact of the banding wasn't noticed. It was only when the AutoCal feature was being utilized. And compared to using the manual controls, Mr. Teo said that it took at least 1,000 measurements to program that 3D lookup table in order to approach the level you could get out of doing the manual calibration. So you will need a fast meter in order for that not to take all day to complete if you're going to go down that route. But until they address that banding function, it may not be something you want to use anyway. Now, there is also a new decontouring filter, which is something Sony actually introduced with their A1E OLED last year. And on the C8 panel from LG, this decontouring filter actually will help eliminate banding artifacts and content that may exist encoded in the video. However, enabling that feature seemed to soften some fine detail in the picture. So it may also be a feature you would want to leave disabled if you're a complete purist and you want the absolute best detail out of the content you're looking at. Another highly touted feature of the LG C8 and the whole 8 series OLEDs for 2018 was something called black frame insertion. This adds a black frame in between each displayed frame to give our eyes a second to kind of catch up. And its effect is to provide improved motion resolution without resorting to, say, motion estimation or compensation, video smoothing techniques that can lead to something like the soap opera effect. Black frame insertion is beloved because of that reason I just mentioned, it not requiring any significant video processing that could add that smoothing. And Sony actually tried this last year with the A1E OLED as well. With black frame insertion technology, I've seen it offered on many new TVs for 2018. It not only decreased the brightness of the picture, that's kind of a given. You're replacing what would normally be a bright picture with a black frame. It also seems to increase the amount of flicker that you'll see in especially bright imagery. So if you're watching like outdoor sports or something shot with superb lighting or just very bright lighting, you may perceive flicker. And if you do, that can be quite annoying. And it's something you probably, again, won't use. One of the best things that Mr. Teo uncovered was the dynamic tone mapping with HDR game mode. Now, this is brand new for 2018. So if you are a gamer and you've often felt that the HDR game modes on OLEDs left something to be desired, you now have the option of enabling this dynamic tone mapping, which effectively allows the TV to look at frame by frame what's happening on the screen and then optimize it in such a way that dark details aren't crushed, bright details aren't blown out. It just simply provides a better viewing experience specific to the game mode that's built in there. And my takeaway from his video that he posted online on YouTube was that I didn't see any show-stopping problems, and this is a TV that will likely improve with every firmware update.
Right.
And it still remains the best picture contrast of any display tech out there with generally superb color, especially post-calibration. It's going to look pretty good right out of the box, but these TVs can be dialed in quite effectively.
What's the pricing on that going to be again?
Very similar. Actually, a little bit less than last year. I want to say for the C8, the 77-inch C8 OLED is about $8,000. And that's what he was reviewing. And that brings up one other issue related to panel size. It seems, at least from the initial testing I've seen, that the larger the OLED becomes in terms of screen size, its ability to dump light out decreases. So it may be a power envelope or a power budget thing in that, well, if you measure full screen white on a 77-inch screen, it measures lower than, say, a 65-inch or going down the line to the 55-inch. I'll take a close look at that going forward. The differences aren't dramatic, but it'll be interesting to see if it's enough to get anyone to who had the budget for, say, the 77-inch OLED to step down just to get more brightness on a specific test. I don't think that's necessarily a huge deal. I think you're still going to get superb color and brightness, especially with your HDR sources. And that kick-ass new game mode is something I'm really looking forward to checking out, considering there are an increasing number of titles on the Xbox and the PlayStation that are offering HDR output authored to literally Hollywood levels in terms of luminance and color. This is going to be, I think, just a fantastic year for new TVs. And between that TCL 6 series and the new LG 8 series, it's a good time to be considering a new display, if you are.
Oh my goodness. So for Nathan, should he get the larger LCD or a smaller OLED, or does it completely depend on whether or not, you know, he wants the ultimate image quality versus incredibly good image quality?
I think at first it's going to be your budget. Let's say for your average size living room, I think a 65-inch screen is ideal. Mm-hmm. Do you have $1,000 or do you have something closer to, say, $3,000?
Right.
If the decision comes down to something like that, you're going to go with the LCD. Likewise, if your budget's a little bigger, and let me just pull up the current pricing. Via Amazon, let's see, the LG C8 OLED. The 55-inch, which apparently will be released in about a week, will be $2,500. The 65-inch, currently available, $3,500. And then the 77-inch, like I said, a cool, currently $9,000. So, yeah, it's just ideally, I mean, I think everyone wants an OLED. It's just that,
Everybody wants an OLED, but do you really want to pay for it?
But when we start talking about, say, that 65-inch screen size, you're talking more than three times the money right now compared to an LCD. And
that's a significant increase in expenditures.
The interesting thing, though, is at least with the comparison with the TCL 6 series, you're talking about similar brightness levels, too, of the OLED and the LCD in this case. In that case, I think I'd be more tempted just to say, the easy answer is the TCL 6 series. Full array local dimming, superb contrast performance. Off axis and color is not going to be equal to what the LG OLED's capable of, but man, the value is just so strong. It's really
hard
for me to
get the best TV you can afford in the size you want.
Totally. Totally. And so, don't go small. Especially when people say average sized living room. You can get away with quite a bit.
I will be honest with you.
A 55-inch screen is easier to move around.
But I've got I've got a 100-inch screen in a 14-foot wide living room. 12 inches of the living room has lost to bookshelves on one side.
But with good light control, you can get away with that. With projection.
Yes.
That's always going to be the best value for a really big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt.
Oh,
but
my goodness.
You got to be able to control that light.
Moving in another direction. Towards the future, we're both big fans of Harmony remotes here. We've both used them on and off for 11,000 years. Oh, look, we're getting back into that whole Google, am I a robot?
Just got to add the and the so.
So. about Saturday.
Oh, man.
The point I was getting to those is we're both big fans of Harmony remotes, and Harmony does a fantastic job of bringing all of your devices together and turning umpteen remote controls into a single remote control. Now, you might like the fact that your Roku remote has an audio jack on it, or you might be a particular fan of the volume control built into the Apple TV remotes, or you might for some reason actually like that old school 1989 era remote control with 72,000 buttons that came with your AVR, despite the fact that your AVR cost $2,000 and you bought it a month ago. But hey, yes. You know, we all like what we like, and we're allowed to roll with what we're comfortable with. But the whole idea of what's going on with the Harmony remotes is that you hit a button and your Blu-ray player turns on and it changes your television to the appropriate port.
They refer to it, I believe, as activity-based programming of the remote. So it's like, what do you want to do? Oh, I want to watch TV, or I want to watch a movie on disc or streaming or however you want to do it.
It simplifies.
I want to listen to music. So you buy those activities that are clearly labeled. It makes it easier for other people in the household who might not be as technically inclined.
Well, it's also just nice to not
to do
be
what
like,
they want.
I need this remote. Well, I mean, you have a choice, right? You can program the audio controls into your Blu-ray remote control because you want to use one remote control, which is just, you know, who wants to go around and manually let me stop going down this particularly boring rabbit hole and say, you know, Harmony's been kind of the standard. If you aren't going to go for a commercially installed system, you know, by the
you know, like Control 4 or somebody like that, where that's
the
a
kind
whole
of stuff we see at Cedia, where it's like, you know, we can get you into this for about $12,000. That's including the initial installation, but any follow up visits for additional equipment will be approximately. And I love it. Installers get to eat too, but most of us can't afford the cost of a Control 4, much less the cost of the installation for a Control 4. And by the way, you're not going to be able to buy the Control 4 system without buying it from a dealer who does the installation. My point being is that Kavo is something we saw a long time ago.
Yeah, a couple years back.
It feels like a couple years back now. And it is, the idea at Kavo is that they're going to take remote controls to the next level.
Now, this thing looks like an HDMI switch.
It is
a very,
HDMI
very nice
switch.
One.
So it looks like a piece of furniture, right? There's black, shiny plastic with a swappable wooden overlay and a bunch of brass sort of spots across the front that make it look very fancy in kind of a Etsy shop way, which to me is not a bad thing. There's a, you know, the underside of the remote control is bamboo. There's a big brass looking Kavo button on the front of it.
It might not look terrible sitting on the top shelf or
might not. Yeah. You won't,
on the
you
table.
Will not be, many people will not be embarrassed by the sight of this, you know, in their living room. Right. So, but I want to say, like, you know, it was probably a year ago when we first heard about it, this idea of a next generation remote control system. And it was going to use machine vision, which is where I immediately started getting confused. And it was going to operate all your devices. I'm like, why do you need machine vision? And that's what gets interesting about Kavo, is one of the sort of subsets, you know, the
it's
Kavo
aware.
Entertainment, yes. It knows when you've been bad or good, just like Santa Claus. But what it does, right, is for the set of devices it can control, Dish, DirecTV, Xfinity, Roku, Fire TV, NVIDIA Shield TV, Apple TV, what it'll do is you will say, watch this thing, and it will automatically open up not just, say, your Roku, but it will open up the application you want on the Roku to the program you're actually looking for.
Oh, that sounds ideal.
When it works,
okay,
it is amazing.
Because having something that would be port aware in terms of you connect your devices to this,
mm-hmm.
and it's aware of where signals are and what things are, and depending on how this has to be programmed, like in the case of a Harmony, you have to start off by telling it everything. It's like, okay, what devices do you have?
Well,
what specific ports are things plugged into?
You still have to do that with Kavo. The setup on Kavo, you know, is kind of like the setup on a Harmony remote without the years of tuning that the Harmony remote has had.
And one of the strong points of Harmony was the fact that their database of compatible products is approaching, if it's not already exceeded, like 300,000 devices.
Right.
So it's a laundry list of everything supported by a damn Harmony. And it's infrared based, which, you know, has its ups and downs. You can do some RF with it as well. But anyway.
Well, getting back to the depends Kavo. On which harm you have. But so Kavo, what it does is it's got all these HDMI ports, and it's got the machine viewing intelligence, and the whole entertainment assistant part's really fascinating because, you know, if you've got a Roku or an Apple TV with a Siri control, it will do all of this next level stuff. Because what you do is you program it to recognize and control all of your devices, including your television and your AVR, and you verify it in the setup process, and then you give it the logins to Netflix and Showtime and whatever services they cover, and it's really kind of crazy.
Are these services actually built into the Kavo itself, or is it taking your login information and actually like utilizing that within the hardware you have?
A little bit of both, I believe. It needs to know what you have access to, so it knows what you have access to. So if you search for something, it can search through all the compatible devices. So if you if you have
that makes more sense.
If you've got Showtime or you know Netflix or any of a pretty long list of compatible services, it goes pretty deep with that whole Kavo Entertainment Assistant. What can be frustrating is when, for example, I have a compatible device like an Apple TV and I have PBS on it, which is an application on the Apple TV, because it does not have that deeper level of integration with the PBS application the way it does with Netflix or iTunes television shows. When I search for, or my wife in this case, you know, presses the microphone button and says, you know, does the search for Call the Midwife, it directs her towards all of the currently purchasable options for Call the Midwife, but doesn't know season 7 of Call the Midwife is available on PBS, right?
Sounds like something that could be addressed with software.
I think so. And I think this is a really interesting...
It's a growing problem more than anything.
This is a really interesting product, right? The future for this is probably to have it integrated into an inexpensive or a less expensive soundbar or other devices, or maybe to license
like
it to television.
Maybe in like an AVR.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, there's a bunch of stuff it does really well, you know, for the major services with, you know, if you've got a couple of the compatible devices, you know, it did fine controlling, you know, for stuff like your Blu-ray player, you know, a DVD, a Blu-ray player, a set-top box for cable, older streaming boxes, it does fine as a remote control. But where it really comes into its own is when that Kavo Entertainment Assistant is doing your stuff. And I will say there's some stuff that is not as sophisticated. I can hit the Kavo button on the remote control and it allows me to see my watch lists for Netflix and HBO and Showtime. You know, it makes it really easy for me to launch an application and immediately go to the last thing I was watching or to something I've been watching recently without having to be like, okay, click, 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 click. Or, you know, the other day I was having one of those moments where Netflix, I think, changed the order of stuff and I was trying to find the stuff I was watching and I'm scrolling through rows and rows of content and every time I pause, it starts to be activated. So just having the watch list on the base of the Kavo overlay.
Oh, that's cool.
It is cool because, you know, they're doing HDMI overlay. They're doing their intelligence. They're doing their machine vision. They're doing a lot. So they're doing a relatively limited number of units. They're not trying to sell all the units to everyone, which I think is really, really smart. I hesitate to say beta, but I will say early adopter in terms of their audience base. Yeah, this is $400, right? It is not cheap for a remote.
Still, though,
they are doing a limited scale rollout of the devices. There's a limited number of these, which I think is 5,000 units total they want to sell this year.
For me, it was the interface itself. Yeah. Just having that awareness of what content do you have available, mm-hmm. and for the compatible services, and that ability to quickly select through it, the ability to change inputs on the TV,
right,
or to go between the devices you have connected.
It's pretty slick. I mean, for me to, you know, I hold the microphone button, I say, watch Goliath on Amazon Prime, and it brings up Billy Bob Thornton getting his, you know, alcoholic lawyer on Amazon Prime, and it'll do it on Roku or Apple TV, depending on which one I ask it to be the primary for Amazon Prime. This integrated content search is really, really cool, and it's really way beyond anything we've ever seen. There are some caveats with it. Probably the biggest one for the sort of people who will immediately shell out $400 for a remote control like this are going to be a little frustrated by the fact that it does not support HDR in its current version. There are moments, if you're the kind of person who punches buttons, you know, if you are a high-speed remote control navigator of joy, if you are the Jimmy Johnson of your generation when a remote is in your hand, you might find the pace of Kavo's switching to be a little Stately.
Just menu navigation or just simply changing between sources and devices?
Well, if I say watch Goliath on Amazon and I'm currently inside of another device doing something else, it's going to do its thing as it opens, it switches and it opens up and it starts its machine vision and it's looking around and it grabs the thing and it opens the thing and takes you to the place. You know, what might take me like 6 seconds with a remote control might take it 12 or 15 seconds. I think a lot of that's going to improve with firmware updates and experience.
For some folks, that may not matter. It's like, you know what?
Yeah.
It's more about being able to simply, a la Harmony, just say, here's in general what I want to do. Here, and you just make it happen. And if it takes a couple of seconds to do it, so be it. It's not wholly different from what Harmony's doing in the sense that when you switch between, say, watch TV to watch a movie, say on your disc player, it will change inputs and fire up the appropriate devices and take care of all of that for you. And it's not instantaneous, but and it's usually doing it over infrared, which can have its own set of hiccups and handshakes and horrible issues, but still.
It's interesting. It has some difficulty with projectors. So I was kind of, in some ways, the worst case scenario for testing this because I did a review for the crew up at the new Screensavers.
What brand of TV do you have?
I don't have a TV. Yeah. Well, but it's fortunately, I have an Epson projector. So it was able, you know, it did pretty good at turning on the Epson projector. It uses IR, not CEC, for power control, which I thought was odd, but they basically said that CEC power control on televisions is a little squirrely in their experience, so they try to avoid it. So there's a very nice IR blaster, beautifully wrapped cables, a nice aesthetic thing going on. The remote looks pretty sophisticated. The box itself looks pretty sophisticated. It is pretty cool. You know, I think it was Nile Patel over at The Verge who said, I don't know if I'd use it myself, but I'm totally buying one for my parents because it brings everything together and for these primary services makes it super easy to do things. And if you don't, if you have to go to PBS to watch Call to Midlife, you know, it does a really fantastic job of mapping all of the buttons from the Kavo Universal Remote to the devices you're using.
That's
impressed.
Cool.
100-day trial if you buy it. So $399. It is 4K. Doesn't support HDR, doesn't support Dolby Atmos, doesn't support 3D surround sound. So
it's a subscription service in addition?
No, you pay $399, you get lifetime support, tech support.
But the 100-day trial is like, hey, if it just isn't for you, send it back.
Basically, if you don't like it, if it doesn't make
your home
theater experience more awesome, give it back to us. So,
Fantastic.
CAAVO.com, Kavo.com. Really cool. Read the FAQ. Look at the devices you have. If you have a normal television and you're not, you know, my situation where I've got my media closet is behind my projector in a large room, and I have a projector. I'm at like the far end of the bell curve for the configuration on this. If you're a normal human being with a rack of home theater devices by your television, the setup on this is going to be pretty easy. It's cool.
Indeed.
I liked it a lot.
Looking
just need
forward
them to
it.
To get the next generation to get that HDR support on 4K.
Got to get you an HDR projector. Stage three.
I'm going to need to save my pennies.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, let's start with the maybe a 65-inch TCL 6 series.
Oh, man.
Or R series, excuse me.
One step at a time. At Evan Adams tweets, at AVXL challenge, try to explain 444 versus 420 in reference to 8-bit versus 12-bit HDR Vizio panels on a podcast. was actually in the tweet.
Oh,
I
that's
did not
hilarious.
Add that.
Holy cow.
Say hello to Chroma subsampling.
Yeah, indeed.
What's a Chroma?
Chroma, effectively, you can think of it as the color in a video signal.
If a boy chroma loves a girl chroma very, very much.
You can go down this rabbit hole as far as you want in terms of the exact terminologies and things like that, but we'll just keep it simple. We're talking about chroma subsampling, and it's the fact that humans see more black and white or luminance detail than they do color detail, be it static imagery or in motion. The way the rods and the cones in our Mark I eyeball are set up, we are better optimized to simply see that black and white imagery. With that in mind, you think about the notation like 444 or 422 or 420. That is a three-part ratio of how the color has been compressed. You almost always see 4 at the very beginning. That represents no compression. In these compression schemes, they say, you know what? We're going to leave the black and white information at 100% detail. But if we can squeeze the color without much in the way of degradation of the image itself, then, hey, we can save a lot of space. And so when we get into these ratios, like, say, 4:2:2, Monroku Ultra actually supports a 4:2:2 output mode. And what that is doing is having the horizontal resolution of the color information, but the vertical detail or the vertical resolution of color remains 100%. Now, when you step down to, say, 4:2:0, both the horizontal and the vertical resolution of color are cut in half, with the appropriate shrinkage in terms of the bandwidth needed to transmit or save or record something like this. Most Blu-rays, actually all Blu-rays, are done to 4:2:0. That's the primary way we're able to squeeze these beautiful, you know, 1080p or 4K movies onto a disc without the disc being the size of, you know, a Frisbee or a hula hoop, by using this type of color compression. Mm-hmm. In the case of this reference with Vizio panels, I'll go back to when they launched their original R series, their reference series, a number of years ago. It was kind of the birth of Dolby Vision at the time. And with that content, one of Dolby's signature claims of that particular piece of technology is that they're doing 12-bit. The question then became, it's like, well, compared to, say, like HDR10 with its 10-bit color resolution, how is that being done yet still staying within the envelope of the available bitrate? And in the case of, say, 12-bit 4:2:2, one of the interesting things at the time was that if you wanted to feed a Dolby Vision compatible signal from a PC into one of these TVs and trigger its Dolby Vision mode, you could actually encode that 12-bit 4:2:2 signal into an uncompressed or 444 8-bit signal and then deliver that to the TV. Now, before people's eyes start rolling, when you talk about bits in color, keep in mind that it's not that the color palette is any larger or smaller. It's simply that there are more steps in terms of the shades of a particular color. Say, instead of having 256 steps between the brightest and the darkest version of this particular color, you can have 1024. Ideally, the more steps you're going to incorporate into your video, the less likely you're going to have artifacts like banding and other things you don't want to see in your video recording or encoding. In particular with 444,
right,
that is effectively uncompressed. And you could think of that very similar to what just a straight RGB signal would be. When these signals are being fed back to a display, the display will detect what that color format was, and with its mathematical prowess, it converts everything back to RGB for display. All display devices, no matter what format it's receiving, be it uncompressed RGB or 444 or 420 or 44 or 422, it doesn't matter. The TV, when it goes to fire that information at the individual pixels, will convert everything back to RGB. Or an uncompressed version of that signal. So ideally, you would have no compression at all. And you would start with 444. You would output 444 to the TV. It would then have very little to do in the way of guessing what those other colors may have been, preserving the full resolution of the color detail in addition to already the luminance detail. That's 100% as well. It's effectively color compression. And it's based upon the biology of our eye. And it's a way to save a lot of space while still delivering very compelling image quality at just simply less space or less room or less bitrate. That's why we have things like DVDs and Blu-rays and all of that good stuff today. We don't encode RGB or 444 on these discs. No, we cut some of that color information out. If we really want to go down the rabbit hole, think about which colors are we most sensitive to.
Right.
In all of our display devices today, they're generally what they call tri-stimulus devices. They use red, blue, and green. Mixing those, just those three primary colors, into every shade you see. So effectively, if the eye is most sensitive to green and least sensitive to blue and red somewhere in the middle, you generally want to keep that green information maybe where it is. But if blue can be squeezed by, say, 80% and you wouldn't really pick it up in most scenarios, or most people wouldn't notice, there's a lot of detail or a lot of data that can be saved in terms of either the encoding scheme or the delivery scheme, be it broadcast or disc or whatever. In the end, it just comes down to a really handy way to make that video smaller and at better quality. We wouldn't have digital video today as it exists without these types of systems. And the fact that it's based in biology just kind of makes me, it's like, that's pretty damn neat, actually. Some researcher spent a lot of time testing people to figure out exactly how the rods and cones are working. Whenever you see that 444-420. Right. Oh, on the PC side of things, it's important.
Finish that sentence. Whenever you see 444-420, it is a...
It is referring to how compressed that video is in terms of its color information.
444 being the least compressed.
Yeah.
420 or 4...
420 is what most of us are looking at in terms of all the broadcast content and any disc you've purchased with video on it, specifically DVDs, Blu-rays, and UHD Blu-rays. They use the 420 format just to save space in terms of things like streaming services, of course. The difference between, say, Dolby Vision versus HDR10 is, are they doing it to 10 bits with less compression or 12 bits with more compression? Or, you know, there's a balancing act between bitrate versus color detail versus what target size are you looking for. Now, on the PC side of things, 444 becomes critical for a lot of gamers or people who want to use these TVs, these UHD TVs or HDR TVs as a PC display. The signals coming out of a personal computer generally are uncompressed. So a lot of people are looking for TVs that specifically support 444 input. And on a lot of the new TVs, in order to enable something like that, you actually have to not only feed that signal to the TV, but then go into usually a submenu within the TV to say, hey, I want you to actually accept these high bandwidth signals and to leave them uncompressed and don't do anything funny to them so that I'm getting 100% color information from a source device that actually supports 100% color information in addition, of course, to 100% luminance detail as well. But I find it more of a bigger deal on the PC side of things. When you start getting to things like 444 signaling from or uncompressed color signaling from any of these modern devices, that's where it can start testing your HDMI cable in terms of the bandwidth it's supported. It becomes really easy to break a cable in the sense that you have a cable that didn't support, say, the full spec of the latest HDR format. It was a cable you purchased maybe a few years ago, and it was good for 1080p at 444, but when you start pushing 4K at a uncompressed color format, you can easily saturate that link or the cable itself. That's where you want a verified 18 gigabit HDMI cable if you're using that.
But that's where you want to check yourself before you wrek yourself.
Three-part ratio. I always think of the first number as referring to the luminance information. So that's always going to be 4. And then the other two simply describe how much of those color difference channels are being compressed. And makes is sense. It by half the resolution in one direction or the other, or a quarter resolution? If you compress it enough, if you take it down to the most compressed formats, you can actually see artifacts start to develop. It's easier to see in test patterns and things like that.
For normal human usage, it's not going to be an issue.
No, and just realize too that is there a reason then, say, for a playback device like an ultra high def Blu-ray player to have the player do the conversion back to RGB or 444 before feeding it to the TV? Considering most of these source devices are feeding TVs 420 anyway, I'm always tempted to just leave it as that going to the TV because these TVs are almost expecting that format and they should be able to do it perfectly in terms of regenerating, say, a 420.
Yeah, just change it to whatever you feel like and see if your television responds.
You're not getting the absolute color detail as you would from an originally uncompressed video signal, but in terms of what you can perceive and is it good enough? And hey, do we get to enjoy a small file relatively compared to a giant fire hose of data that's unwieldy? Those are the trade-offs.
I mean, this also falls under the sections of things you can manipulate inside of your set-top box / Blu-ray player / television that will invariably on paper deliver, quote, better image quality, unquote, but won't actually be perceptible in most situations and may break your ability for your set-top box and your television to speak to each other or for your television to display the information from your set-top box.
I mean, ideally, if you're reviewing these types of products, you wouldn't just simply test it. If you're sending output from your PC to a TV, it would be ideal that that TV support uncompressed color input because the PC is delivering it. It's one of those great devices we have that a lot of people have that can actually spit out an uncompressed color signal. And for the rest of our content, be it broadcast or disc, like I've said, it's less of an issue because the TV is going to convert everything or whatever the display device is. It's going to do the conversion back to RGB anyway. But then it becomes, can you run some quick tests, though, to see which display or the source device is doing a better job at that conversion back to RGB or 444 before it hits the display?
Couple last things before we go. At kiddo1986, emails, tweets at Patrick Norton. Does what I want exist other than a full AVR? Desktop amp with two speaker output, sub port, either SPDIF plus USB or two SPDIF and a headphone output, quarter inch preferred. I'm Googling it, but it seems to be I either get speaker, DAC, amp, or headphone, not two in one. There are definitely all-in-one options that combine the ability to power speakers on a desktop and do headphone output and accept digital signal in from your phone or your desktop or your network. They're just not as common as I think they should be, mostly because so many of the people who are buying stereos or stereo amplifiers, I think are really, really behind in a lot of ways. Not the amplifiers themselves, but the preamplification and integrated amplifiers. It's incredibly common to have a dedicated subwoofer output for a AVR. It is considerably less common for an integrated amplifier to have a subwoofer output. One of my favorite ones out there is the TA-100 from Emotiva. I have the preamp version of this that does not have the integrated amplifier. It's pretty slick in the sense it's a preamp, it's a DAC, it's a tuner. Along, you know, the TA-100 has subwoofer outputs along with the speaker outputs from the amplifier. It's basically everything that Kiddo's looking for. He also asked, not cheap, and it's not that expensive. When you realize it's a pretty clean 50 watt per channel amplifier with all of this other preamplification stuff, it's $399. It's more expensive than some of the gadgets on Amazon, but it also is a company that's here in the United States and probably a lot easier to deal with for warranty repairs should you actually need one. Kiddo then asked, I use one of the RCA outputs to go to a powered sub, like a Monoprice subwoofer? And yeah, they basically, that particular preamp, and as we're starting to see on more preamps these days, has instead of like a left and a right subwoofer output, it's got two summed full range outputs. And you can connect each of those to a subwoofer. It's a pretty simple setup. It's something to look for, though. For example, the difference between the Nuforce amplifier, like I have that Nuforce amplifier that has dedicated, it is a DAC and it is a Class D amplifier and preamplifier and all in one. My one challenge with that is it doesn't have a subwoofer out. So
right.
There's a lot of subwoofers now that won't accept a full amplified output. Like a lot, for example, the Shoe, you can basically run cables from your amplifier to that Shoe subwoofer. It'll peel off the signal it needs and ignore the rest of it. But for a lot of amplifiers now only have an RCA jack input. And if you don't have an RCA jack output, you can't use them, you know.
I was going to say it's definitely not it may not even be available anymore, but I keep thinking of the Oppo 205. It has headphone output, it has USB for a DAC input, it has analog outs for all the speakers, it has balanced stereo out, It has your coaxial opticals, it's got a lot. And a USB power in addition to data, HDMI input, in case you want to connect something external, But we're talking like $1,300 and the company's going away, so...
Looking
at the page right now, it actually says register for potential availability. So they may be taking the very last orders of these, doing one last run. And so if you are interested in the Oppo UDP 205, oh, yeah, and it's an ultra high def disc player in addition to a universal disc player. But that, to me, is still one of the neatest.
It is.
Jack of all trades.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, without a doubt. That's some loot.
Hey, something I want to tell everybody about, if you are fans of anime, especially of Studio Ghibli, if you've never heard of it, there's a thing called Ghibli Fest going on this year. Maybe it goes on every year, and I just didn't know about it before, but I found out about it recently. But if you're fans of, Porco Rosso, Princess Mononoke, Grave of the Fireflies, My Neighbor Totoro, Spirited Away, Castle in the Sky, all of the kind of classic, I guess they did this last year too, all of the classic Studio Ghibli movies, Miyazaki movies, they are actually bringing them to theaters. You can actually see
on
some of your favorite
screen?
Movies. Yeah. On the base. So, you know, I need to remember to pre-order tickets today for My Neighbor Totoro because my kids are huge fans. They're also huge fans of Spirited Away
and
Castle in the Sky. So they will be able to see these things in a theater, in a group movie experience, which they don't do too often.
Boy, if they do that up in Dolby Vision or Dolby Cinema, I should say.
That'd be pretty crazy. FathomEvents.com. The Last Jedi Blu-ray, if you're curious, looks gorgeous and is also tied into movies anywhere. which is nice.
I need to break down and buy all of the quote-unquote new Star Wars movies on that are available now and get caught
Solo
up.
Solo is coming. I got invited to preview Solo. I'm half excited and half terrified.
That should be... I expect that to be pretty cool.
I hope so. We got to hang out for our patrons on May 23rd at 4 p.m. Wanted to give you an early heads up to make sure everybody knew about that. That is patreon.com/AVXL. If you aren't already a patron of the show, we would appreciate it if you went and checked it out. And of course, for our patrons, we'll be invited to that patron hangout on May 23rd at 4 p.m.
Very cool.
More next week, ladies and gentlemen.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for listening. Remember, ask@avxl.com is the email, or tweet @Robert Heron or @Patrick Norton or @AVXL. I got a wrap. I love you guys. Thanks for listening. And ladies,
aww,
for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Robert Heron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.